Councilor Bejan, before we get going, I want to make sure that, before we get started, I want to make sure that we're squared away with the, that we've consolidated the arguments this morning.
That's what we were informed, Your Honor. Yes, thank you.
And you're aware that I extended argument time to 20 minutes. So I need to know from you how much time you're going to reserve, 10 minutes for rebuttal?
So they're consolidated 20 minutes. So
the arguments in both cases are now consolidated. And instead of 15 minutes, you're going to have 20 minutes to address the issues.
My assumption when I was asked, when I checked in, was that I would argue the appeal 1446 in my opening time and then both have my rebuttal on 1-4. I'm happy to do it however you, whatever makes
sense. Why don't
sense.
You address the issues in both cases during your direct and save time for rebuttal?
Okay.
If you need additional time, I'll grant it to all the parties. If we get to that point, is that fine? Okay. So you want to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal?
I'll reserve 7. Total? I'll address both issues in the first 13.
13?
And I'll reserve 7.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may begin, please.
Your Honors, may it please the court. Thank you.
Just housekeeping. Do you agree claims 1-8 and 10 are illustrative?
For the 1446 appeal, yes.
Okay.
We have claim 9, which is the wire claim, which is, I'll agree that's illustrative for the 1451 appeal.
Okay.
So claim 1 with the primarily transmitted issues, claims 8 and 10 primarily with respect to...
And another housekeeping question. If we affirm on obviousness, does that moot your other appeal?
If there's an affirmation on petitioner's appeal in the 1446, I think that does moot the other appeal.
Yeah. But that's their appeal.
That's why I waved my hand at opposing counsel.
You can answer that when you get up. I assume the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to the 1446 appeal, and with respect to claims 8 and 10 primarily, and the combination of the Gestesi reference and the Berghauer reference, our position is that it should be reversed because the board's finding regarding the motivation to combine is simply not supported by substantial evidence.
Well, on that point, I'd like to hear your comments on the issue of commercial viability and the reliance on that.
Our position was that the motivation to combine, which was laid out in Mr. Parker's declaration, paragraph 141, said you're going to have this desire to increase use cases for commercial viability. We inquired with their expert as to what investigation he had made into commercial viability with respect to the references in particular.
Yeah, and he said he didn't. Right,
and I think that's a...
But why is that relevant? Isn't a reference prior art for all it discloses?
Absolutely. And we agreed with this at the... We just to make it crystal clear, we are not disputing in any way that Gestesi qualifies as prior art and that Berghauer qualifies.
And for everything they disclose.
That's right. And for everything that they disclose. Under the SAS case, the petitioner controls their petition, and they control the basis on which they're going to have a motivation to combine. Our position was that when they said that a person of ordinary skill in the art would be motivated to make the combination based on a desire to increase the commercial viability of the first reference, that put it in play, but exclusively for the issue of motivation to combine, not for anything else, but only for the issue of motivation to combine. The board, I think, struggled with respect to the issue of Mr. Parker's generality with respect to it, that he didn't support...
You say he only provided a, quote, generic reason.
That's the language we used, yes, Your Honor. I think generic reason, general reason. I think this we had cited to the court in our briefing the active video case,
mm-hmm.
which indicated that...
And Polaris.
Yeah. And Polaris. And the court on November 22nd of this past year in the TQ Delta versus Cisco 942 F3rd 1352 again indicated that conclusory and unsupported motivations to combine were inadequate. And I think that's just part and parcel with that same
Why is it relevant that they're commercially viable or inviable?
I think it's relevant that an expert, if they're going to proffer a motivation to combine along the lines of make it better, make it safer, make it more commercially appealing, our reading of the case law is they need to orient that to the references at issue. So I think if a person of ordinary skill in the art says, I look at reference A, Gustessi, a race car, and Gustessi says that it's important for cornering and handling that you have good tire traction. And I've got reference B that says I've got tires with great traction. I think an expert could opine and create the combination of new tires with Gustessi's race car.
Because that combination would increase more sales or attract?
No. Simply because it would provide better handling. So that was the and maybe my analogy didn't take super well. But I think from our side, if you're going to come in and offer commercial viability as a foundation for a motivation to combine, it needs to be oriented to the references. If you're going to come in with the idea of increasing use cases,
You don't challenge it, just the use of commercial viability as an element that could be used to show a motivation to combine.
No, and I don't think we're not citing Active Video or the other cases from this court to say that that's per se rejected. What we're saying is, like an Active Video, where they wanted to make it better, where they wanted to sell more units. In Active Video, I think, and like here, you're obligated then to develop that argument more and present more record evidence to explain why. That's all we're saying. We're not saying that it's per se bad or per se off limits. What we're saying is, if you're going to go down that road, it has to be more than conclusory and unsupported. The board then went and used the background of the invention and our expert, Mr. Kunstelman's agreement with the background of the invention to find that he agreed with the concept of making the combination based on commercial viability. And there, I think, the board, we characterize this as a potential reversal of the burden of proof under Magnum Oil. I think it also could be characterized as a failure to look at the record as a whole. We argued that the board sort of completely didn't look at our experts' expressed disagreement.
This is what you always argue. All of you argue this every single time when you present your experts and the board disagrees with you. You come in here and say either they didn't look at it improperly, even though we presume they did, or you argue that they've shifted the burden to you under Magnum when all they're doing is looking at your evidence and rejecting it. That's not a reversal of the burden. It's just they don't agree with you.
I certainly agree there's room for that, absolutely. I think here...
Can you point to any place in the board's decision where they say you didn't carry your burden of proof?
No.
Well, then they didn't shift the burden improperly. It's this implicit this argument that they have somehow implicitly shifted the burden under Magnum Oil makes no sense when they've cited the right burden, and all they're doing is addressing your arguments or finding them insufficient. That's not a burden shifting.
Well, Judge Hughes, I think that in the manner we argued it, with respect to the motivation to combine, I think the board was obligated to look at the fact that Mr. Kunstelman expressly disagreed with the motivation to combine based on commercial viability.
How do we know they didn't?
They didn't say it. Under Nuvasiv, they didn't say it at all.
Again, this is it. The board isn't obligated to provide a detailed point-by-point rebuttal of your case. They're required to look at the record and make a decision. And even then, on review, we can't fault them for that unless they clearly have not done something, if they've clearly ignored something. The fact that they didn't specifically address it doesn't mean they've somehow shifted the burden or ignored the evidence. They've reached a reasoned conclusion on the record, and we're going to review it for substantial evidence.
And our position with respect to the motivation to combine is simply that they were obligated to at least comment, and we have no, at least look at the record, especially where it's so dramatic. He disagreed point blank with the commercial viability reason, and the board used his agreement with the background as a basis to say that he in fact agreed with the commercial viability. And maybe that doesn't answer your question directly, but it is a substantial evidence.
It suggests to me that the board did indeed look at your expert's declaration and disagreed with it. The fact that they are not the other side in this case. They are not obligated to rebut your arguments point by point. They're obligated to look at the record and reach the decision.
That is the process. I would like to move on. And
you're going to talk about unmet need?
What I'd like to talk about is this idea of under personal web, I can happily talk about unmet need, and I'll make it quickly for the board did go through point by point the seven reasons why Mr. Kunstelman did not, or was unpersuasive with respect to why you'd use Berghauer's radial motors into this. They went through that. I think our problem there is under personal web, because the petition and Mr. Parker in their opening declaration said that a person would put those exact motors, 2, which is the radial motor, and 3A, onto Gestesi, that it was BMW's burden of proof to explain how to do that and why it would be successful. So for the analysis by the board to focus on why we couldn't rebut that when BMW never put that out in the first instance demonstrates either a failure to look at the record as a whole or with respect to unmet need, our view there is simply that when the board used our general engineering statement from the background of our invention as a basis to say that there's a desire to increase use cases for a universal or modular chassis, that they needed to look at the fact that BMW filed an application on the same issue, or on the solving the same problem 2 years later. Simply that, just that it needed to be done consistently.
How is Grill relevant to claim 10 of the 163 patent?
Claim 10 mm-hmm. is directed towards a hybrid vehicle with an electrical motor and an internal combustion engine in the combination with the universal frame, as is Greel. So they're both directed to hybrid platforms. In my last 5 minutes, I can shift to the other appeal for a few minutes so I can reserve.
Yes.
I think our positions are fairly simple with respect to the claim construction of primarily transmitted, which follows as such that we offered a claim construction in patent owner's response. BMW had an opportunity to offer a claim construction in the petitioner's reply. They did not. That issue is now being raised here for the first time. We believe it's a waiver. Notwithstanding, we believe our claim construction is correct, that the such that clause signals a indication of the function of the chassis in the environment in which it's found. With respect to the wire issue, it too is substantial evidence. The board indicated that there was a stalemate, on the issues between our evidence and their evidence with respect to the experts. To me, that's 50-50. And so the board looked at other evidence, and we believe substantial evidence supports that other evidence tipping the scale at 1% more. And for that reason, we believe that that should be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you, sir. OK, Councilor Sumac, you have 20 minutes should you need that amount of time.
Let's do that in 15 and 5, please.
Okay.
May it please the court, Jeff Sanok on behalf of BMW. I want to address, first of all, the 1441 appeal with respect to the motivation to combine. I believe...
Do you mean 1446?
1446, I'm sorry.
Just to make sure that the recording is clear.
Yes, thank you. The evidence supported that there was a known desirability in the automotive arts to design a chassis to be made available for multiple use cases. Design incentive is motivation, but it wasn't the only motivation. There was also the interrelated teachings of the patents that Mr. Parker explained in detail with respect to the Gestesi and Bergauer references. Together, you had substantial evidence of a motivation to combine. What the board did here is very simple. They looked at Mr. Parker's testimony on this known desire to increase the use cases. They then saw that Mr. Kunzelman, the patent owner's expert, agreed. And they saw that the background of the 163 patent even confirmed that known desirability. With that, they had no question to look for any other evidence with respect to whether there was sufficient motivation to combine. But there actually was. As we said, Mr. Parker pointed out the interrelated teachings of these patents. You have the Gestesi and Bergauer references, which were both directed toward modular backbone types of structures. You had in the Bergauer reference an express object of trying to optimize the use of space because batteries and fuel tanks could take up a lot of space. So Bergauer looked to put it into these backbone support pipe. You had the Gestesi reference, which also used the backbone support pipe for its energy source for its combustion engine. You had Gestesi with a modular chassis design that not only stored the fuel there, but had two different embodiments where you could switch out the engines on the front module.
So Mr. Parker also opined on commercial viability, right?
What he said was to increase the commercial viability. What his statement was that it was a known desire in the automotive arts with respect to chassis designers when you, to design a chassis to make it available for use across multiple use cases in order to increase the commercial viability of a chassis. So yes, he did make that statement. What happened is in his deposition, he was asked essentially a wrong question. It was asked whether the Gestesi reference was commercialized or whether the Bergauer reference was commercialized. That became the whole linchpin for this commercial viability, commercial success, commercialization types of arguments that the patent owner have now been making. But the board examined that.
So help me understand what Mr. Parker was trying to say. Was he trying to say that there's a motivation to combine because if you do so, you'll result in greater sales down the road?
Not exactly, Your Honor. What he's saying is that when you have a desire to make a chassis more viable by making it available for more use cases, you're going to increase its marketability. So it is...
increase the marketability. Is that an element for motivation to combine legally?
Market forces is an element, as is design incentive, which is what we've talked about, as is the interrelated teachings of the patents. And all of that was set forth in several paragraphs of Mr. Parker's declaration. And again, the known desirability to do this, which is the motivation if you're a chassis designer, was agreed to by the patent owner's expert. Our case follows essentially the logic of the board in several cases, the PGS geophysical case and the ZUP LLC versus Nash case, where the board did examine the motivation. They also noted that there was no dispute that all the elements were met in the combination of the references, and then they went forth and laid out the arguments against the secondary considerations evidence for which the patent owner does have a burden of production. And they did that quite clearly in the final written description over, or, excuse me, final written decision over several paragraphs and pages. What I want to turn to next, unless there's any questions on 1446.
Well, just the one you answered already.
Is I'd like to go to the written description, the written description issues with respect to 1451.
Okay.
And there, we believe the board erred. And I'd like to start with primarily transmitted limitation, because I think that one's a little
bit... Again, this is the one we don't need to reach.
Correct. Yes.
Affirm on the other one.
Yes, this is correct. Once their options for exhausting appeals, of course, are over. With respect to the primarily transmitted limitation, one of the positions that we've taken is the claim one of the 163 patent states that the ride handling and impact crash loads are transmitted between the front and rear structures through the backbone. Now, the ride and handling loads, they're agreed, those are chassis loads. They're defined in the patent as being the chassis loads. And consistently throughout the entire family, those chassis loads are described as being transmitted solely or entirely through the backbone. And that makes sense. You have a front structure, a rear structure, and then you have a central backbone. There's no frame surrounding that central backbone. Therefore, the loads are chassis loads are solely through the backbone. The 163 patent explicitly states that. Because there's no frame, the unichassis, because the unichassis doesn't have a frame, the loads are solely, the chassis loads are solely through the backbone. But let's take a look at the impact crash loads, because the patent owner has made an argument that the structures haven't changed or the function hasn't changed. But let's look at the impact crash loads and how those changed. I'd cite you to Appendix 1923, which is the red line version between the 490 application, for which they claim priority in 2008, and the 2012 CIP, for which we claim they're not entitled to any earlier of a date. And if you look at Appendix Site 1923, you'll see it's in color. The blue changes are what has been added in the 2012 CIP. So if you could read that passage in paragraph 6, which is up at the top and it's right about in the middle of it, it states that the object is to take the chassis loads and decouple them from body loads and impact crash loads. So in 2008, in the 490 application, the chassis loads are decoupled from body loads and impact crash loads. Now, read the blue in 2012, in their further disclosure, where they had added a lot of disclosure about crash boxes throughout the spec, it now says that those chassis loads are still decoupled from body loads, but also the impact crash loads are now absorbed to the backbone, absorbed through the crash boxes to the backbone. So the structure did change. You had impact crash loads in the 490 application, and that passage is the only one where impact crash loads are discussed anywhere in the 490 application. They are decoupled from the chassis loads, and in 2012, they are now absorbed to the backbone. That's a contradiction that can't be resolved, and therefore, for that reason alone, the impact crash loads can't find support, even primarily through the backbone, from the 490 application. And then further, when you have the 163 filing patent, you'll see that they changed the term solely to primarily. And for support, because they had none and this only showed up within the claim, they went to look at a passage in the 163 application that is unrelated to how the loads are handled in the chassis. That passage has to do with isolating the body from the backbone using body mounts. And it simply says that if you can isolate the chassis or the body from the backbone using the body mounts, you've substantially decoupled the loads. and only substantially because there's weight, and weight obviously would affect still the backbone. But what they never show is, and I should say the board in their findings said that, well, that's evidence of sharing of loads, and therefore we find written description. But that, first of all, doesn't track the claim language, which isn't just sharing of loads. It is primarily transmitting them from the front structure to the rear structure through the backbone. And that's what gave rise to what we anticipated they would argue, which is that there's some alternate load path from the front structure to the rear structure that goes through a body when the body is on the chassis. Two problems with that. The first problem is the 490 application, and if you look at appendix site 1532, you'll see on appendix site 1532, this is the published 490 application. And if you look at claim 15, this is also on page 54 of our blue brief. They had a claim, which is part of the original disclosure of the 490, their priority, which says you have a body, it is mounted to the backbone, but it still says the chassis loads are solely, I think it says entirely there, or solely through the backbone. So even when they try to rely on this passage of a body being mounted to a backbone, their earlier disclosure is still consistent with what the intent was, which is the chassis loads are still solely through the backbone. And a similar claim like that even exists in the 2012 CIP at appendix site 1761, claim 11, where again, now they have a claim with the body on it, which is what they've been arguing. You have to read their claim one of the 163 patent as having a body. But now you have a claim that they wrote with a body, and it still says the chassis loads are solely through the backbone. So we believe there's no substantial evidence to support the board's findings with respect to the primarily transmitted limitation. Secondly, with respect to the alternate load path, it's a claim construction issue only because impliedly they had to reach that view. Otherwise, the loads would still be going through the backbone because nothing else connects the front structure to the rear structure. And even their own drawing figures make it clear that the body is just mounted to the backbone. And with that, let me address the wire limitation, unless there's any questions. On the wire limitation, this is essentially a case where the board applied an obvious-to-try or obvious-to-use analysis. There is no express disclosure of a wire in the 490 application. The only language that is being relied upon by the patent owner is a discussion of how you assemble their chassis, where they say you suitably couple components together. That's not a structure, suitable coupling. That is essentially a method act. So there's no actual structure of anything that is a electrical conductor within the 490 application.
If you have a power source on the front of the rear frame, then yes. on the front frame, and then on the back, and there's a hollow tube between them, wouldn't that imply that there's a wire connecting the two?
It would likely imply that there may be a conductor of some sort, but not necessarily a wire. That, you know, Mr. Parker testified that there are numerous other conductors available to couple batteries. Bus bars are used extensively in battery packs. That's part of the record. So are.
But if the point is to put batteries inside the hollow tube that's connecting yes. everything, then there must be a wire there, right, to connect everything.
Not necessarily. As Mr. Parker asked, you can connect it with other conductor structures, such as bus bars.
A bus bar is effectively a metal conducting rod. Right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And what we're really, and if to take it another level though, further, you have to look and say what is their actual claim language. For example, one of their claims talks about a wire and spanning the entire length. Mm. Well. if you have batteries in that you're connecting to, that wire isn't spanning the entire length. They may be referring there to a different type of wire, such as a wiring harness in the vehicle that goes from one end to the other, doesn't connect to the batteries at all. And in fact, I think that's maybe what they were aiming at, but there's no disclosure of that until they filed the 2012 CIP, where at that point they put in ample disclosure of not only fluid lines, electrical lines, how they're located, the purpose, why. But as of the 490 priority date that they're claiming or want to claim, it may be obvious to use one, Your Honor. I'll be the first one to agree with that. But that's not what the law is.
Correct.
There's no actual disclosure. There's no express disclosure. There's not even an actual structure, as we said. It's just suitable coupling something.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, I'm sorry. With that, actually, I will, Scott.
Okay. Thank you. He's got 10 minutes? 7 minutes. Okay. Correct.
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the motivation to combine on the 1446 appeal, petitioner argued that there was a lot of record evidence pointing to specific things in the patents themselves that supported that combination. I would direct the court to appendix page 1277, which is the opening declaration of petitioner's expert, Mr. Parker, who's talking about combining drive motors 2 and 3A of the hybrid vehicle. And this argument was repeated in the petition itself. Under Personal Web, Mr. Parker needed to explain how we're going to take drive motor 2, which is a radial engine like would be found on a World War II aircraft, and motor 3A, which is an electric motor, which are both cantilevered off to the sides, and explain how those would be integrated into the race car of Gustessi and why that would be successful. Mr. Parker did not do that. Mr. Kunzelman explained why that would not be done, could not be done, wouldn't work. And so therefore, you know, under Personal Web, to the extent that that's used as a motivation to combine, our position is it's equally conclusory, it's equally unsupported. With respect to commercial success, commercial viability ever commercialized, our questions to Mr. Parker were very clear in the deposition and set forth in our brief. We didn't ask him about commercial success. We didn't ask him whether those references qualified or did not qualify as prior art. We asked him if it was commercially viable, point blank. Commercial viability doesn't necessarily mean it has to be sold. Just would anybody be interested in, even in your opinion? And he did not have any investigation. So I think that this commercial issue has come into the case and exited the case and come back into the case and exited the case. It's come in as a basis for a motivation to combine, utterly conclusory, utterly unsupported. When we criticize it, there's a step back and saying, wait a second, commercial success is not relevant. And then the board says, your expert agreed that it would be commercially viable. So from our side, someone had said, it looks like a rat, smells like a rat, or something's up here. To us, we feel like we've been whipsawed by this whole, it's either relevant or not, I agree. But if you're going to put it into play, you got to support it. It's got to be more than simply conclusory.
Well, it's in play. The board relied on Mr. Parker's testimony, right?
And it had to be supported in more than conclusory. Turning to the primarily transmitted.
I don't understand what you mean by more than conclusory. Are we talking about the statement on 1275 and in paragraph 151 where it says this would increase the commercial viability of the design?
Yes. So all of paragraph one. Paragraph 151 is the basis for motivation combined. Our position is that it is conclusory and it's unsupported.
What do you mean it's conclusory? Conclusory would be a skilled artisan would have a motivation to combine without giving any reason. He gives reasons here. Does he have to prove that it would have been commercially viable? Or can he just say as an expert, I think this would increase commercial viability?
I think you have to, our position is that it's got to be oriented to the references. You can't.
Why?
I think because
He's the skilled artisan, we're not.
I think if it wasn't tied to the references, Activision would have gone the other way. Polaris would have gone the other way.
Well, but it is tied to the references. The first two sentences talks about what these references disclose. It said one of skill in the art would have been motivated to use Berghauer's motors with something in Gustacy, and then the ultimate conclusion that this would have increased commercial viability.
If that's the case, I'll accept your hypothetical. BMW argued that it's irrelevant, that commercial viability.
Well, because there's other parts in here that they talk about other reasons for why
and
you would combine that.
Sure, and we go to page 1277. The other reasons is because both drive motors 2A and 3A, and we're now talking about specific motors, that you'd put these specific motors in, except there's no explanation of how you would put a radial engine that's cantilevered off to the side like your ear on one side and the electric motors like your ear on the other side and how that would go in. So I'm not disagreeing that you couldn't use the references, the subject matter of the references themselves. All I'm saying is you have to explain why under personal web for there to be substantial evidence. With respect to the claim construction issue, primarily transmitted, the board, Appendix 160, agreed that both experts agreed on the issue. They didn't argue the claim construction issue. With respect to the wire, substantial evidence. And with that, unless you have any other questions.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to compliment everybody on the nice illustrations.
You have 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'd just like to address one point made with respect to personal web. What's missing in that analysis of personal web is it's not only are you having to show the combination, but you're in the way claimed. And here...
This is going to the obviousness question, right?
Yes.
I mean, we didn't really treat these as cross appeals, but this is his appeal. Shouldn't he get the last word on that?
That's correct.
I mean, if you have something on... I mean, if they want to hear it, if my colleagues want to hear it, it's fine, it seems to me.
I think I was just thrown off by the consolidationist way, but I apologize. So I have nothing further on the, unless there's anything you'd like to hear on the wire and primarily transmitted.
Thank you. Okay, we thank the party for the arguments. This court is now in recess.
All rise.